undeserved. What an honourable answer, said Lydia Wells. And a truthful one, I hope, said Moody. Aha, said the widow. We are back to truth again. Gascoigne had been watching Lydia Wells. You see how her mind is working, he said to Moody. She will swoop down in a moment and savage your argument. Prepare yourself. I hardly know how to prepare to be savaged, Moody said. Gascoigne was right. The widow lifted her chin and said, Are you a man of religion, Mr. Moody? I am a man of philosophy, he rejoined. Those aspects of religion that can be called philosophy interest me extremely. Those that cannot, do not. I see, said Lydia Wells. I'm afraid that in my case it is quite the reverse. It is only those philosophies that can be called religions that hold any interest for me. Gascoigne laughed outright at this. Very good, he said, wagging his finger. That is very good. Moody was amused, despite himself, by the widow's acuity, but he was determined not to let her take the upper hand. It seems that we have little in common, Mrs. Wells, he said. I hope that this lack of common ground will not be an impediment to friendship. We disagree upon the validity of spirits. We have established that much, said Lydia Wells. But let me put the contrary question to you. What about a soul, a living soul? Do you believe that you can know a person who is living if you cannot know a person who is dead? Moody considered this, smiling. After a moment, the widow went on. Do you believe that you could ever truly know your friend Mr. Gascoigne, for example? Can you see him from all sides? Gascoigne looked very peeved for having been used as a rhetorical example, and said so aloud. The widow shushed him, and put the question to Moody a second time. Moody looked at Gascoigne. In fact, he'd anatomized Gascoigne's character to a very fine degree of detail over the 3 weeks of their acquaintance. He felt that he understood the scope and limits of the man's intelligence, the quality of his sentiment, and the tenor of his many expressions and habits. He felt, as a whole, that he could summarize the man's character very accurately. But he knew that Lydia Wells was intending to trap him, and in the end he chose to reply very blandly indeed, repeating that he had only arrived in Hokitika but 3 weeks ago, and could not hope to form an accurate assessment of Gascoigne's soul in such a time. That project, he added, would require more than 3 weeks of observation. Mr. Moody was Mr. Carver's passenger, Gascoigne put in. He arrived on the Godspeed that very night she came to ground. Moody felt a stirring of unease at this disclosure. He had used a false name while booking his passage upon Godspeed, and he did not like to advertise the fact that he had arrived in Hokitika upon that craft, given the nature of what he had witnessed, or imagined that he had witnessed, in the hours before the ship had foundered. He looked at the widow, seeking in her face some flicker of doubt or recognition that might show that she had known about the bloody phantom in Godspeed's hold. But Lydia Wells was smiling. "Did he?" she said, looking Moody up and down. "Then I'm afraid Mr. Moody is a very common specimen of a man indeed." "How so?" Moody said stiffly. The widow laughed. "You are a lucky man who is scornful of the notion of luck," she said. "I'm afraid, Mr. Moody, that I've met a great many men like you." Before Moody could think of a reply to this, she picked up a small silver bell, rang it sharply, and announced, in a voice that was no less penetrating for its husky half-whisper, that all those without tickets were to make their departures at once, for the sales was about to begin. Venus in Aquarius, in which Sukyong Sheng forgets his shilling, Lydia Wells becomes hysterical, and we receive an answer from the realm of the dead. What a different gathering this was to the clandestine council that had assembled in the Crown Hotel 3 weeks ago. The Crown had played host to a party of 12, which, following Moody's arrival, became a party of 13. Here, in the front room of the Wayfarer's Fortune, there were a party of 11 seeking to summon a 12th. Charlie Frost, under Joseph Pritchard's instruction, kept his eyes fixed upon Lydia Wells as the widow led the 7 ticket holders into the parlour where Ah Sook and Ah Kui, shining with grease paint, sat cross-legged on either side of the hearth. The drapes had been drawn over the parlour windows, and all but one of the paraffin lamps had been doused, giving the room a pinkish glow. Above this last lamp, a tin dish of attar had been placed on a metal stand, and the liquid, gently heated by the warmth of the flame, filled the room with the pleasant scent of roses. Mrs. Wells invited the men to take their seats, which, in the interval while the other guests departed the wayfarer's fortune and dispersed into the night, had been arranged in a circle in the middle of the room. There was much embarrassment and nervousness in the room as the 7 guests were seated. One man kept emitting a high-pitched giggle. Others grinned and elbowed their mates in the ribs. Mrs. Wells paid these disturbances no notice. She was busy arranging 5 candles in a star pattern upon a plate and lighting them one by one. When the candles were lit and the paper spill extinguished, Lydia Wells seated herself at last and remarked, in a voice that was suddenly hushed and conspiratorial, that Anna Wetherill, these hours past, had been preparing her mind for the impending communion with the dead. She was not to be spoken to when she made her entrance in the parlour, for even the smallest disturbance could disrupt her state of mind, which in turn would disrupt the widow's own transmissions. Did the present company consent to ignore her? The present company consented. Did the present company consent to assist the widow's transmissions further by maintaining a state of mental receptivity for the duration of the event? Would every man agree to keep his mind cool and open, his limbs relaxed, his breathing deep and rhythmic, and his attention focused absolutely, like that of a monk at prayer? This was assured.
"I cannot tell you what will happen in this room tonight," the widow went on, still speaking in a voice of conspiracy. "Perhaps the furniture will move about. Perhaps we will feel breezes, the breath of the underworld, some might call it, as the spirits around us are disturbed. Perhaps the dead will speak through the mouths of the living. Or perhaps they will reveal themselves by the presentation of a token."
"What do you mean, a token?" one of the diggers said. Lydia Wells turned her calm gaze upon the speaker.
"Sometimes," she said quietly, "and for reasons unknown to us, the dead are unable to speak. When this happens, they choose to communicate in other ways. I was party to a seance in Sydney where this occurred."
"What happened?"